Thank you all for holding, and welcome to the E.coli outbreak update. All parties will be in a listen-only mode. Today's call is being recorded. The replay number for today's call is 888-566-0619, and will be available once the call is over, and it will be available until October 5th. I will now turn the call over to Dr. Diana Hajabegovic, and thank you, ma'am. You may begin.
Thank you, Laurie. Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us for today's special clinician outreach communication activity conference call. This is a special COCA conference call, and we will be talking about the current E. coli 0157H7 outbreak related to fresh spinach. The purpose of the call will be to discuss CDC guidance for clinicians working directly with the patients. We will not be providing a full account of the investigation or the outbreak. For that information, we refer listeners to the FDA and CDC website. We are pleased to have Drs. Patricia Griffin, Dr. Klontz, and Dr. Phil Tarr today on the call to discuss these issues. Dr. Patricia Griffin joins us from CDC. She is an internist. Dr. Griffin has supervised epidemiological investigation throughout the United States and overseas. She has authored and co-authored many journal articles. Dr. Klontz has been with the FDA from 1989, where he has working as an epidemiologist with the Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition. Dr. Tarr is from the Washington University School of Medicine. He is the author of many publications on E. coli infections. Dr. Klontz will be presenting overview of E. coli 0157H7 outbreak and FDA role. Dr. Griffin will be providing CDC guidance for diagnosis, testing, treatment, and follow-up of patients with suspected or confirmed E. coli infection. And Dr. Tarr will be talking about a clinician perspective on interpreting guidance on treatment of E. coli 0157H7. We are pleased to have this presentation today. Dr. Klontz, you may begin.
Okay, thank you very much. Good afternoon. My mission is twofold here. First, to present an overview of the current outbreak, and second, to discuss briefly FDA's role in the investigation of this outbreak. But I'd like to begin by taking a moment just to commend our state and local health departments throughout the country for really, it's been their Herculean effort that's allowed us in the last week not only to learn about the outbreak, but to pinpoint the cause of the illnesses, namely fresh spinach consumption. You know, once again, state and local health departments have shown themselves to be an indispensable backbone of our country's public health system. With that, let me turn to the outbreak itself and specifically how it was recognized. In early to mid-September, health officials in Wisconsin detected an unusually high number of persons with recent E. coli 0157H7 infection. About the same time, other states were noticing smaller clusters of 0157H7 infection that exhibited a matching pattern on pulsed field gel electrophoresis, or PFGE, a DNA fingerprinting technique used to subtype bacteria. The outbreak was formally identified on September 13th by OutbreakNet, a network of public health epidemiologists who investigate foodborne disease outbreaks. It became clear early on from interviews with ill persons that consumption of fresh spinach during the week prior to onset of illness was a feature shared by the vast majority of cases. In fact, on September 14th, one day after the outbreak was formally identified, fresh spinach was implicated as the cause of the outbreak. That same day, September 14th, CDC issued its first health alert on the outbreak, and the U.S. Food and Drug Administration issued a press release advising consumers not to eat any fresh spinach. With the release of these two public notices, the industry and regulatory authorities began a collaborative effort to remove from the market fresh spinach and products containing fresh spinach. Another outbreak feature that became apparent early on was the virulence of the outbreak strain. As of September 15th, for example, of the 94 cases that had been reported by that date, almost a third had been hospitalized and 15% had hemolytic uremic syndrome. Let me now summarize then the overall outbreak, covering its time, place, and person features. Now, the numbers I report here were obtained from CDC's latest daily update, compiled at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time yesterday, September 20th. CDC will issue its next update later this afternoon and can be accessed on its website, a site, incidentally, that offers a wide range of valuable information pertaining not only to the outbreak, but to E. coli 015787 in general. As of September 20th, then, CDC had received a total of 146 reports of infection due to the outbreak strain of E. coli 015787 in persons whose onset of illness occurred between August 2nd and September 9th. Cases have been reported from 23 states. Among ill persons, 76 or 52% were hospitalized, 23 or 16% developed HUS, and an adult in Wisconsin had died. Cases ranged in age from 1 to 84 years, with a median of 27 years, and 5% were children under the age of 5 years old. As has been the case in many previous produce-related outbreaks, more cases have been reported among females than males in the current outbreak. Specifically, 103 of 146 cases, or 71%, are females. The outbreak appears to have peaked between August 19th and September 5th, a period during which 93% of the cases had onset of illness. The latest onset date among reported cases is September 9th. The two states reporting the most cases are Wisconsin with 40 and Utah with 16. On September 20th, New Mexico's Public Health Laboratory announced that it had isolated the outbreak strain of E. coli 015787 from an opened package of spinach that came from the refrigerator of a patient who had eaten some of the spinach before becoming ill. The package of spinach that tested positive was Dole baby spinach, best if used by August 30th. Finally, to complete this overview of the outbreak, I'd like to briefly present other evidence that helped implicate fresh spinach as the cause. Using a questionnaire to elicit a detailed history of spinach consumption from cases during the week before onset of illness, the most recent tally of these questionnaires indicates the following. 91% of cases reported eating spinach. Second, the vast majority, 94%, reported eating spinach raw. Third, 88% reported eating a prepackaged spinach product, with the vast majority of these indicating the spinach had come from a bag. And finally, among those who'd eaten prepackaged spinach, 97% reported eating it at home. At this point, I'd like to briefly discuss the activities the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has played during the outbreak. And my comments will fall into three categories: investigation activities, outreach and education efforts, and monitoring of recalls. Beginning with investigation activities, from the outset of learning of the outbreak, FDA has collaborated with CDC and state and local health departments in a number of ways. For example, the agency has participated with CDC and the health departments in daily teleconferences during which the latest details of the outbreak are summarized. The agency has also collaborated with CDC to design the spinach questionnaire I mentioned earlier, a tool that has helped us understand the role spinach has played in this outbreak. Along those lines, FDA is working with CDC to analyze the data collected in the spinach questionnaires using information such as brand names, dates of purchase, UPC codes, lot numbers, and so on, in an effort to identify the source of spinach contamination. This effort entails conducting so-called tracebacks, a process whereby records are collected sequentially to elucidate the path of product associated with illness traveled from the point of consumer purchase all the way back, ideally, to the production site. At this point, to the best of our knowledge, all brands of spinach implicated in the outbreak were grown in three counties in the Salinas Valley area of California. Accordingly, on September 19th, teams formed by FDA and the California Department of Health Services, Food and Drug Branch, began investigations at 9 different farms in the greater Salinas Valley area. Finally, in terms of investigation activities, FDA laboratory assistance has been offered to help states test leftover spinach samples collected from ill persons for the presence of E. coli 015787. In terms of outreach efforts, FDA continues to advise consumers not to eat fresh spinach or products that contain fresh spinach until further notice. Fresh spinach includes bagged spinach, spinach in a clamshell, and loose spinach purchased from retail establishments such as supermarkets, restaurants, and farmers markets. At this time, FDA has no evidence that frozen spinach, canned spinach, and spinach included in pre-made meals manufactured by food companies are affected. These products are safe to eat. FDA has also advised commercial food establishments not to sell fresh spinach or salad blends containing fresh spinach to consumers. Such establishments have also been advised to avoid opening and minimize the handling of fresh spinach and other fresh spinach-containing products to prevent the potential for cross-contamination of other foods and food contact surfaces. These and other FDA recommendations and notices may be found on FDA's website, a site where one can also access the press releases FDA has issued since September 14th, daily releases, and announcements and updates of ongoing voluntary recalls of products containing fresh spinach. And speaking of recalls, I'd like to complete my talk by summarizing FDA's monitoring of these recalls. To date, there have been 3 voluntary recalls announced for products containing fresh spinach. They include, first, the announcement on September 15th by Natural Selection Foods, LLC of San Juan Bautista, California, of products containing spinach with best if used by dates of August 17, 2006 to October 1, 2006. Second, a recall by River Ranch of Salinas, California, announced on September 17th, involved the recall of spring mix containing spinach. River Ranch obtains bulk spring mix containing fresh spinach from Natural Selection Foods for processing and packaging. And third, a recall announced on September 19th by RLB Food Distributors of West Caldwell, New Jersey, involves certain salad products that may contain spinach with the enjoy-through date of September 20th. Spinach used in their products may have been supplied from Natural Selection Foods. Finally, it should be noted that products subjected to recall were also distributed to Canada, Mexico, and Taiwan, but to our knowledge, no outbreak-associated illnesses have been reported from these countries. This completes my presentation, and at this point, I'll turn the microphone over to the moderator.
Thank you, Dr. Collins. Dr. Griffin, you may start.
Hello. I'm glad to talk to you about E. coli 157, one of my favorite pathogens. I want to start by just giving a bit of an overview about E. coli 0157. The press often just calls it E. coli, and as you clinicians know, we have many E. coli in the gut of humans and animals. It's in the environment. E. coli 0157 is a particular strain of E. coli that has the O cell wall antigen number 157 and a flagellar antigen that's called number 7, and it's a particularly pathogenic organism, partly because it contains a toxin that's been called Shiga toxin, and that's named after Dr. Shiga. And Dr. Shiga was also responsible for naming the Shigella bacteria. And one of the Shigellas that we rarely see in this country actually carries a Shiga toxin. But these organisms are very different from Shigella, and I want to point that out because sometimes there's confusion that when a laboratory reports that there's a Shiga toxin present, people might think that the patient has Shigella. But when they're testing for Shiga toxin, they're testing for these E. coli that include E. coli 0157. E. coli 0157 is one of a class of E. coli that produce Shiga toxins. There are others in this class that also cause diarrhea and can cause hemolytic uremic syndrome. It can cause pretty much the same disease, but E. coli 0157 is by far the most common, the most frequent cause of outbreaks, and clearly the one that needs most attention. And it's much more common than the others in the United States. How common is E. coli 0157 infection? In the United States in 1990, we in CDC estimated that there were about 73,000 illnesses with E. coli 0157 every year. And that includes people who are diagnosed by the laboratory and people who get sick and either don't get the right stool culture done or don't even go to their doctor. The illnesses have been decreasing, mainly due to changes in the contamination of ground beef and improvements in the the cooking of fast food hamburgers. And recently, we think there's been about, from that point, about a 29% decrease. We're still following those trends. Still plenty of E. coli 157 in this country. So I tried to think about some questions that clinicians might want to ask, and we'll try to answer some of them and then not talk for too long because I want to give you a good opportunity to hear Dr. Tarr's perspective from his taking care of many of these patients, and I also want to leave plenty of time for questions. So if one of your patients calls and says, I ate fresh spinach in the past week or two, and I'm nervous, what should I do? The answer is just relax about it. Don't do anything. And in particular, there's no need for the physician to get a stool culture from that patient. If a patient has diarrhea, then we recommend that a stool culture be done. This recommendation gets stronger if the patient has severe diarrhea or has bloody diarrhea. We published our recommendations for treatment, their Infectious Disease Society of America guidelines that were published in the CID journal in 2002. And what we say is any diarrheal illness that lasts more than a day, especially if the patient has fever, bloody stools, systemic illness, recent use of antibiotics, attends a daycare, is hospitalized, is dehydrated, has decreased urination, fast heart rate, postural signs, any of those things should push you even further towards getting a stool culture. And it's interesting in this context, certainly a fever should prompt a culture, but E. coli or 157, 10 patients tend to have little or no fever, probably partly because the disease is mediated by a toxin, and toxins don't always cause fevers. So we would suggest that you get a stool culture. Also, if you have a patient who has hemolytic uremic syndrome that's associated with preceding diarrhea, or in an adult, the patient might have a diagnosis of thrombotic thrombocytopenic purpura, but if that disease is preceded by diarrhea, most of us now call that hemolytic uremic syndrome. And that disease is due to E. coli 0157 until proven otherwise. E. coli 0157 causes 90% or more of those illnesses. And we strongly urge you to get a culture for E. coli 0157 in any of those patients. And part of the reason to get a culture is to know what the diagnosis is and so that you can think about what are the best decisions for treatment, which we'll go into later. But also then it gets into the public health system, and this is the way and really the only way that we detect outbreaks is the laboratories report through the public health system whenever they get an E. coli 157 strain. We then do DNA fingerprinting, and it's those reports that enable us to detect common source outbreaks like the spinach outbreak. So it's really essential. So one thing I thought that you might be interested in is to know in your relationship with your clinical lab, what are they doing? So if you get off this call, you might want to know what should you ask your clinical lab. And I would say you would ask them, do you look for E. coli 0157 in every stool specimen? And you might be surprised to hear that not all laboratories do that. You send a stool culture and it could come back negative. That doesn't mean that they looked for E. coli 0157. In our most recent survey of a sample of national laboratories, 69% of them said that they looked for E. coli 0157 in every sample using sorbitol McConkie medium, which is a special culture plate that they use to screen for E. coli 0157. So if they say that they do it, then, well, first of all, if they say they don't do it, then ask your laboratory to add E. coli 0157 to their routine enteric panel. Then you're sure that when you do a stool culture, they've looked for this virulent pathogen. If they say they do it, then ask them what tests they do. The test that's most specific for E. coli 157 and will give you the fastest answer is culturing on sorbitol McConkey agar, and we just call that SMAC, S-M-A-C with capital letters for sorbitol McConkey. It allows them to quickly screen, and within 24 hours they can tell you if they have a suspect E. coli 0157. Another test that's being commonly used and is easier for some labs because it's more automated is an ELISA test for the Shiga toxin. If that test is positive, then you know that the patient has an organism in his or her stool that produces Shiga toxin. And that could be E. coli 0157. It could be one of the other Shiga toxin-producing E. coli, some of which can cause disease as severe as 0157, but some of which cause only mild diarrhea. Some of these laboratories will just report that result to you, and then that's all they will do. And then they will throw the specimen away. And then all you'll know is that there's a possibility that the patient has E. coli 0157 infection. What you would like is for them to do both that SMAC agar and the ELISA test at the same time. That's a bit much and expensive for most labs to be willing to do. But the minimum that we want labs to do is when they report that a stool specimen is Shiga toxin positive, they immediately culture on SMAC so that they can tell you right away if it looks like they're growing an E. coli 0157. In addition, whenever they get a Shiga toxin positive or whenever they isolate an E. coli 0157, we want those specimens or isolates sent to the public health laboratory because we track these illnesses. And the E. coli 0157s get further analyzed in the public health laboratory. They get subtyped, and that's how we detect these outbreaks. I wanted to get a little bit into treatment of diarrhea, and then soon after that we'll move to Dr. Tarr. For diarrhea in general, we do not recommend enteric antibiotic treatment because of the self-limited nature of most of these illnesses. The cost of treatment, the potential for promoting antibiotic resistance, and whenever you give an antibiotic, there's certainly the possibility of adverse drug reactions, both allergic reactions to the antibiotics, and then some people will develop C. difficile colitis after antibiotic treatment, or they may get vaginal yeast infections. So you know there are side effects, and most people, by the time that they go to the doctor with diarrhea, the antibiotics would not do a lot of good. There's also, we know that antibiotic treatment is appropriate for certain subsets of people. For example, some people who have severe diarrhea and have a high risk of invasive salmonella infection, persons in developed countries where Shigella or Vibrio are common. And in those countries, often we don't have laboratory support. So there's always clinical judgment in whether or not to give antibiotics as treatment for diarrhea. The consideration has to be given to whether the patient might have E. coli 0157 infection and how to think about treatment for those people. Things that would increase your suspicion that it's 0157 infection is the stools are bloody, the patient has severe abdominal cramps, especially on the right side, and there's little or no fever. But as people in practice would know, there's and we've actually looked at data on people with diarrhea due to different organisms, and there is no clear algorithm that we have with that we can put into it fever and a type of diarrhea and come out and tell you that it's likely to be one due to one pathogen or another. But if you strongly suspect E. coli 157, there are some concerns about antibiotic treatment. Whenever a person has diarrhea, it's important to hydrate people. We know that there are fluid losses in diarrhea, and hydration is very important. And Dr. Tarr is going to talk more about the particular importance of hydration in E. coli 157 infection. Also, in colitis, there's data indicating that giving Imodium or loperamide can increase the risk of complications, and we do not recommend that. For E. coli 157 in particular, there's some retrospective data suggesting that that could actually increase the risk of complications. With E. coli 157, there's some particular concern about antibiotics, and those concerns come from looking back at people who've been treated with antibiotics, and some of those people have been more likely to develop hemolytic uremic syndrome. There are many reasons why looking back at treatment can be a biased way of making a decision, but we've also looked at whether antibiotics have helped in the treatment of E. coli 157, and we haven't found any good data that patients who were treated with antibiotics actually did better. So there's been some work in mice and in vitro also suggesting that giving antibiotics can increase the production of shigatoxin and increase the risk of complications. So in particular for E. coli 157, we have concerns about patients receiving antibiotics. So if diarrhea is known to be due to E. coli 157, most U.S. experts at this time would not recommend antibiotics. Most of these patients will have been ill for several days, and there's no evidence that treatment at this point is beneficial. I think I've given enough to start with, and
thank you, Dr. Griffin. Dr. Tarr, you may begin.
Thank you. Drs. Klontz and Griffin provided very good background to the outbreak at hand and general approach to patients with these infections, either suspected or confirmed. What I'd like to do is go through a list of frequently asked questions, much like Dr. Griffin did, at a provider level that we found useful in our hospitals here in communicating to people treating these patients. What is the incubation period? In most outbreak analyses, it's been about 3 days. I think the range is probably very unlikely to be less than 1 day, and it can extend up to 10 to 12 days. That's a good working frame, in my opinion. And Dr. Griffin can perhaps add more later on about that. Symptoms, E. coli infections are generally quite painful. The profile of a patient with E. coli infection is non-bloody diarrhea that turns bloody between day 2 and 4. The blood is visible to the patient or parent in about 85% of cases, though there is a subset that fails to have any visible blood. Patients are almost never febrile when they come in for medical attention, so about half of patients in most series will report having had a fever, usually during the non-bloody diarrhea phase of illness. The abdominal pain is out of proportion to what one would expect with a case of gastroenteritis. Women have likened it to giving birth. A man who had it told me that it was worse than his kidney stone the year before. So pain is out of proportion to the illness, and the abdomen is often quite tender. I have seen in older children, teenagers, and adults the right side of pain that Dr. Griffin describes. In younger children, it's more generalized and seems to be surrounding the time of having a bowel movement. Who should receive a stool culture? I agree with Dr. Griffin's guidelines. And what's critical here, if this hasn't been portrayed before, is the link between the patient, the provider, and good, rapid microbiology assessment. Call your lab, get on the phone, speak to the microbiologist, and make sure that that individual will plate the stool on sorbitoma conchiagor, especially in a setting like this, E. coli 0157. Are fecal leukocytes helpful or any other rapid tests that can help you distinguish a patient at point of care? No. About half the patients or more have no fecal leukocytes when they present to even high acuity settings such as emergency rooms. What lab tests should be obtained in addition to a stool culture at the time of presentation? I strongly recommend obtaining a CBC, BUN, creatinine, and electrolytes on all patients with acute bloody diarrhea as a baseline. One will need to refer to those values a day or two later when the culture comes back positive. We strongly discourage giving antibiotics, as put succinctly by Dr. Griffin. There is no study that demonstrates any benefit to giving antibiotics. There are multiple studies, flawed as they are, that suggest harm in the absence of any benefit accruing to such patients, and in view of multiple different studies, including in adults, we discourage the use of antimicrobial agents of any class. Then what should one do? If a patient fits a plausible profile for an E. coli infection, I personally think that they should be admitted to hospital and given IV hydration. This is a thrombotic illness. The model for this is not dehydration as in rotavirus or cholera. The model for this is much more that of vascular occlusion following a leading to a myocardial infarction. In people who've died with fulminant E. coli-related HUS, there are thrombi all over the body. When patients present in advance of meeting a case definition of HUS, they have profound activation of the coagulation system. It won't show up with on a prothrombin time, and won't show up with a CBC. It will show up with different tests. When they're in your emergency room or office, they have coagulation activation, whether or not they go on to develop HUS. A well-perfused body, and in particular a well-perfused kidney, is in the host's interest. We strongly encourage IV hydration with isotonic saline or equivalent crystalloid in this situation. Laboratory tests should be obtained daily once the patient's admitted. Follow the platelet count. The trend in the platelet count will tell you if a patient's resolving or getting worse. Almost all patients identified early and followed for several days will have some fall in their platelet count, and then it will come back up, and you can consider them to be out of the woods. When does HUS occur, and how will I know that my patient has recovered without this complication? Follow the platelet count. If it is clearly rising, and that's why you need more than a single value, you are out of the woods. In most recent series, HUS occurs a median of day 8 of illness, with the first day of diarrhea being the day 1 of illness. We've seen it occur as early as day 5 of illness and as late as day 13. That's a reasonable window. You need not observe the patient throughout that entire window, but you do need to observe the patient daily, ideally in a hospital, until you know the trend in the platelet count. What percent of children with E. coli infection develop HUS? 15% of children under 10 in most recent series have developed HUS. This is in the culture-proven category. I am very surprised and quite concerned that this 16% HUS rate in a group of people who are young adults, largely, whom one would not expect to have such a high HUS rate. How do I report a patient with confirmed or suspected E. coli 0157 or with HUS? It is the responsibility of the provider in most states to make that phone call, though laboratories will often do it for you. If there's any doubt, pick up the phone and speak to the local disease control authorities in the county of residence of your patients. How contagious is E. coli 0157 in outbreaks throughout the 1990s? And Dr. Griffin can elaborate. There's been about a 10% secondary attack rate. This is another reason, in my opinion, for hospitalization and the Institution of Contact Precautions. People with E. coli infections, even adults, are biohazards. What does one do with a patient who looks, quote, good, unquote, when the report of the stool culture becomes known? Usually you're out of the woods, especially if you're beyond day 6 or 7 of illness. It would be prudent to get a CBC, and if there's any doubt about incomplete resolution of symptoms, admit the patient, hydrate them overnight, and get a CBC the following day. Finally, can antibiotics prevent an incubating infection? We don't think so. In several outbreaks, the best of which was probably in Toronto in the late 1980s, people who'd received antibiotics during an incubation period for E. coli had a higher risk of a poor outcome, including renal failure or death. So if a patient's pre-symptomatic and thinks that antibiotics might diminish this risk, we don't. There are no data to support the use of antibiotics in this situation. I'd be happy to entertain questions according to the format of the moderator.
Thank you, Dr. Tarr, Dr. Griffin, and Dr. Klontz. Now we can start a Q&A session. I would like at this point ask media, any media people, audience, in any media people in audience to hold their questions and direct them to 404-639-3286, our media relation division. Let's give a chance to clinicians to ask the question. Lori, could you please one more time tell to our audience replay number, and you can start questions and answer session.
Yes, thank you. The replay number for this call that will be available approximately 10 minutes after the call is over, the dial-in number for that is 888-566-0619. That will be available until October 5th at 12 p.m. or 11 p.m. Central Time. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. I will announce your name before asking your question. If your question has been asked and you would like to withdraw your question, please press star 2. Again, at this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. Our first question is coming from Warner Hudson, and please state your organization.
This is Warner Hudson from DST. My question is, what proportion of these patients present with a very mild GI symptoms but with hemolytic uremic syndrome?
I'd be happy to take a stab at that. Is that okay, Patty?
Yeah, I also have data.
Okay. Over the years, looking at several hundred patients with E. coli infections and HUS, patients with HUS who had no severe diarrhea or very mild diarrhea, probably only 2 or 3%. But there's only a moderate correlation between the severity of the diarrhea and the risk of HUS. So one can have fairly mild enteric symptoms and then develop HUS. The mildness of prodrome is not a clear green light. Patty?
Actually, I have some data and I can't find it. Why don't we take the next question and then I'll say that.
Thanks.
Okay, and were you ready for your next question? One moment for the next question. State your organization.
Cannot hear the question.
Michael Sobel, your line is open. Please check your mute feature from Banner Medical Center. Your line is open for your question.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me?
Yes.
The question is, does cooking the spinach and how much cooking protect you from the organism?
This is Carl Klontz, Food and Drug Administration. We're told by microbiologists here, at least at FDA, that this organism is quite susceptible to heat. In fact, one of the recommendations that's given is if one cooks spinach at 160 degrees Fahrenheit for 15 seconds, those cells will probably be inactivated. But this raises a larger question of of whether cooking is sort of a safe way out currently in an outbreak setting in which a food item has been implicated as the cause. And I would really want to suggest caution in thinking that cooking makes clear the path and make it safe, because there's always other possible problems there. Beginning with, we don't really know practically what temperature we're getting our foods unless we see a rolling boil or a thorough steam and so on. The other thing is, when we've got products that are known to be or potentially known to be contaminated, the fact that they're being handled can lead to cross-contamination of counters and other foods. So I just want to caveat that that 160-degree for 15 seconds general rule of thumb with some other possible precautions.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, this is Patricia Griffin, sort of dealing with that other question. I was hoping that I had our FoodNet data at hand. We, as you may know, hemolytic uremic syndrome is a reportable disease in many states, and in our FoodNet sites, which comprise 15% of the population, we collect data on every case of HUS, and so we actually do have data on the proportion that had bloody stools. I just don't have that in front of me. But I can tell you that we did a national study in the late 1980s in which we enrolled 83 people, adults and children, with HUS, and just tried to get a random sample of people with HUS, and only 73% of them have bloody stools. That seems to me to be a fairly low proportion. But I think the message here is that people with bloody diarrhea seem more likely to develop hemolytic uremic syndrome, but it's also possible in somebody who has non-bloody diarrhea.
Our percentage is in the high 70s in children have had bloody diarrhea prior to their HUS. Non-bloody diarrhea, though, were also categorized by families as severe, usually because of the pain. Only a handful had no diarrhea, but we got an 0157 out of their stool.
Right, and so that's true also in thinking about just plain diarrheal illness. If you only look for E. coli 157 in people who have bloody diarrhea, you're going to miss a lot of these illnesses.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from William Rodriguez, and please state your organization.
Yes, I work with the FDA, but the questions and the opinions represent my own, not the agency, okay? I have a question. There appears to be some problems, for example, in Europe, where a fair number of some of the coliforms associated with this disease may actually not be detected in the sorbitol containing agar. So the question is, I like the ELISA screening. But any thoughts on the subject?
Patty, you want to go first?
Trying to figure out how to handle that succinctly. There are some E. coli 0157 that are not detected by SMAC agar. They are vanishingly rare in the United States. They're seen in some parts of Europe. E. coli 0157 is just about the only shigatoxin-producing E. coli that we can find on SMAC agar. We can find all of them by doing an ELISA for shigatoxin. So there's that's one advantage of the ELISA, in that you find all of those shigatoxin-producing E. coli, including 0157. And it's a test that can be automated, so it's easier for some labs to do than culture. So that's a fine test to do. What's important to know is that some laboratories are just getting a positive result, throwing it away, and then the clinician, in my opinion, doesn't have the information that she or he needs to take care of the patient, to report to public health authorities, to deal with what you would do if you really think the person has E. coli 0157 in terms of of counseling the patient, treating the patient possibly in a hospital, and counseling them about the chance of spreading the disease to another person. So that's why we are urging people, contact your labs. If your lab says, we do the shigatoxin test, you say, that's great, but we also tell them if they get a shigatoxin positive, you need them to specifically look and tell you if the patient has 0157.
How about if the 0157 growth is negative? Shouldn't they just still send the sample over to the public health laboratory? Because, you know, with this small barriers now flying across the countries and everything like that, you know, we don't know what the future holds for us.
Yeah, we really prefer that people look for all the shigatoxin-producing E. coli because the others also cause diarrhea, and some of them can cause a disease that's just as severe as E. coli 0157, and we want to continue monitoring them because at some point those could increase in frequency in this country and start causing more illness. So the best thing is truly to look for all these organisms. But while you're doing that, to be sure that you quickly make the diagnosis of 0157.
Thank you.
I'd like to amplify Dr. Griffin's comments. In the United States and Canada now, and dating back as far as 1982 or 3 when these bugs first emerged, at least emerged in our knowledge, 0157 is head and shoulders above any of the others in terms of its ability to cause renal failure or epidemics. Subset of the others are quite pathogenic, and it's quite appropriate to continue to look for them, but it should not be at the expense of rapid, unequivocal identification and on-forwarding of an 0157.
Thank you.
Next question.
Our next question does come from Chloe Cummings, and please state your company name.
Boston State Hospital. This is Dr. Bui in California. I would like to ask Dr. Ta to repeat about the following of platelet counts. Do I understand right that it dropped first, and how long does it drop before it rises again?
In an uncomplicated case, it could drop for several days and then start to rise. Rather than box yourself into a set number of days, it's really a day-by-day analysis. If the trend is down, that patient still has an evolving vascular injury that could lead to HUS. If the platelet count's rising, you're out of the woods.
Thank you.
Thank you. And our next question comes from Karen Fuji, and please state your organization. Karen, your line is open. Please check your mute feature. Karen, your line is open, and please state your organization. I'm going to go to the next question. Our next question comes from William Rodriguez, and please state your organization. William Rodriguez, your line is open. Please state your organization, and you may ask your question.
I believe we had that question already.
Okay, I'll go to the next one. Harold Yeager, your line is open, and please state your organization.
Allegheny County Health Department.
You may ask your question, sir.
At this time, I'm just listening for the chief of the food safety program. I don't have a question at this time. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Lena Guest, and please state your organization. Lena Guest, your line is open. Did you have a question?
No.
Okay, I'm showing a question from Heritage Valley Health. You may ask your question.
Yes, this is Lorraine Mamoni. I was wondering if there's been any preventative measures or a follow-up taken from the 2003 study that was done by the Journal of Dairy Science that showed if cows were switched from a grain diet to hay for a period of maybe a week prior to slaughter, it would reduce cross-contamination And that was actually done from a study that showed a lot of times the contamination occurs in meat, you know, meat packing plants and so forth. Do you have any information on that?
Yeah, I can take that question. Others may want to add to it. This is not CDC data, but we're aware of that data, and there's been very good work to show methods such as the one you described, feeding hay rather than grain, to decrease the excretion of 0157 prior to slaughter. And one of the efforts that that's being made is to decrease the amount of 0157 that animals are excreting when they're slaughtered, because whatever they're excreting as they're waiting to slaughter also gets all over the hides of the other animals that are waiting for slaughter. And then when the animals are slaughtered, what's on the hides can contaminate the meat. And there's actually progress being made in that ground beef is now less contaminated than it was a few years ago. The other big thing that needs to be done is recognition that we have a huge amount of cattle manure without adequate ways to dispose of it, and cattle manure contains E. coli 157. In old studies, before we used specialized techniques, we used to say that a small proportion of cattle farms had animals with 0157. Now we think that virtually all the cattle farms in the United States have animals that carry this virulent pathogen. And what happens to this pathogen in the manure as it sits out in the fields? Well, you can imagine the rain washes it down into streams and rivers and probably even into groundwater. And then from there, it can contaminate the environment, including fruits and vegetables downstream for which the water is used in various parts of the process.
Thank you.
And our next question comes from Jean Arlotti, and please state your organization.
I'm a nurse practitioner in Phoenix, Arizona. And my question is, now that the source has been pulling the potentially affected spinach from the shelves, and we believe this to be the causative agent, and we've been doing this for several days now, and given the incubation period ranging 1 to 10 days, are we out of the woods yet, and are we seeing a gradual resolution of the epidemic, or do we expect more cases? Thank you.
This is Carl Klontz. I'll speak to part of that, and I'm sure Dr. Griffin, Dr. Tarr as well may have comments. We are in a evolving mode here in terms of the natural history, if you will, of this outbreak. Are we out of the woods totally? I don't think so. I don't think we can say that yet. From an FDA perspective, we're placing enormous resources right now on trying to trace back the products that have been implicated in individual illnesses as part of this outbreak. It is true in the last few days we've been we've learned an awful lot in terms of the most likely source being in the Salinas Valley area. The epidemiology and the traceback so far seem to corroborate that spinach indeed was grown there. But before we are comfortable placing the all-clear light out, we really got some more work to do, and we want to make sure we do it judiciously and carefully and do it right. So that's why at this point we're not there yet in terms of clearing the advisory on spinach.
We have time for two more questions.
Thank you. And our next question does come from Karen Holbrook, and please state your organization.
I'm from the San Francisco Department of Public Health, and this is a question for Dr. Tarr. It was an excellent set of FAQs that you shared with us. Is that available electronically or in hard copy for others to, share with their jurisdiction's clinicians?
Sure. If it's okay with Dr. Griffin, I'd like to send it to her, and she can disseminate it. Is that okay, Pat? How should I best get it to you?
You can send us an email to coca@cdc.gov. One more time, coca@cdc.gov, and we can send you information or answers.
Thank you. Our next question does come from Noah Kramer, and please state your organization.
DHA Consulting Group.
You may ask your question, sir.
Yes, I'd like to understand the PFGE pattern. It's supposedly a fairly frequent PFGE pattern, making up apparently close to 1% of the national database. I'd like to know, since January of 2006, and more specifically, over the past 3 months, prior to the outbreak strain that we're associating with spinach, where else geographically and in time has this pattern been seen? Thank you.
We need to skip this question. This is just for clinical audience. You can email to us, coca@cdc.gov, and we will try to respond to your question. One more clinical question, and we have time for just one more clinical question. Thanks.
Payne County,
sorry about this.
Payne County Public Health, your line is open.
Oh. Sorry, this is Shelley McKernan. I had a question for Phil Tarr, and just on, especially for people who present with HUS and you can no longer find the organism and the enterohemorrhagic E. coli, how long does the sugar toxin persist, and is it at that point a good idea to go ahead and try doing the ELISA test for sugar toxin? Will it persist longer, or are you likely to get it after the organism is no longer there?
Very interesting questions. When a patient comes in with HUS, by standard culture, about two-thirds of patients are culture negative at the time they present with HUS, so that's too late to get the organism. There's a few things you can do in that situation. Number one, get on the phone where the patient might have initially presented. Where they come with their HUS, it's usually a tertiary pediatric center or adult center, where they may have presented 3 or 4 days before. Those plates may still be hanging around. Make certain they don't throw them out. Try to get them transferred to a good microbiology laboratory. That can sometimes involve some people skills. Second, you should also do a rectal swab on admission. Patients with HUS frequently have an ileus or have already produced all the stool they're going to produce for a few more days. Do a rectal swab on admission and send that for an E. coli 0157 culture. It's anecdotal, but I've seen a handful of those positive and the first bowel movement 2 or 3 days later when a child has HUS be culture negative. So try to get that done. The toxin in the stool is paradoxical. Even prior to the development of HUS, when there's plenty of E. coli around, there's not much fecal-free toxin. This was published several years ago. So looking at the stool as a target for toxin is probably too late. I would, in this circumstance, also do a toxin assay because the patient could have been cultured for 0157 before it was missed, or they could be among the very rare number of patients, probably no more than 5%, and probably more close to 1 or 2% nationwide, who are truly infected with a non-0157 sugar toxin-producing E. coli. So to review, get the original plates, do a rectal swab, and set up for both a culture and a toxin assay on admission. And save some serum. Serologically, you might need to look at something in retrospect.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Dr. Griffin, Dr. Klontz, and Dr. Tarr for that informative presentation. I would like to remind any listeners who did not have a chance to ask a question to email that question to coca@cdc.gov. One more, coca@cdc.gov. I would also like to remind all listeners that current information regarding E. coli outbreak may be found at the CDC website. Also, I would like to point out that this outbreak is the initial launch of an RSS feed for the event webpage and encourage all listeners to review the CDC homepage and consider linking to the site via RSS to be able to automatically receive the latest information concerning CDC emergency preparedness and response activities. Thank you very much, and stay tuned for our next CAWCA conference call. Goodbye.
That just concludes today's conference, and you may disconnect at this time.
Questions, I'm curious.